to critique, comment, make suggestions on the draft that we had gazetted in September. So you've got 10 minutes to do your presentation, and members would have 10 minutes to challenge it. It is, honourable members, the detail would be your 13th submission, and there is an executive summary of the presentation that will be made now. Mr. Brian, it's Brian, excuse me. Over to you, sir.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. Honourable members, I'm here in my private capacity. I must say I'm very humbled by the opportunity, you know, with my privilege of being able to make comments and that this government is seeming to listen. My background, just to give something of a context, I have 35 years in financial services, so I really understand how, you know, money does influence and how a lot of money does influence a lot. I'm also involved in environmental issues, particularly in the Komiki area with the Komiki Ratepayers Association and the Komiki Heritage Society, and that has also spread my wings across the peninsula, where I've been involved in the what they call the Far South Peninsula Community Forum, which deals with everything below Okasavak, as well as the Development Action Group, which is based in Observatory. It is in a wide-ranging group of NGOs across the peninsula, including groups from Philippi, Kensington, Langa, Boer Kaap, as well as Constantia, Cabs Bay, have got together, and the thought process, there's a lot of synergy in the thought process that come through there. Just up front, I must have to say, from a financial and a funding perspective, I must have sympathy for the funding of a political party. It's not an easy thing. And if I were to say that the ANC had 1 million members and your membership fees are 100 rand a year, that's 100 million rand, which with that deep grassroots branch structure, it's hopelessly too little to fund such an organization on an ongoing basis, because it pays salaries and it pays rental and it pays all the other stuff. But there's also the question of electioneering, and that in my view has become, and is sliding down the slippery slope of becoming very, very big business. And if I'm right from listening to the media, the ANC let it slip that in the last national election it was 1 billion rand. And the DA let it slip that in the counting portion of the last national election it was 100 million rand. I've just read a book, and maybe the committee would get a copy and try and read it yourself, written by Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, where she describes a system in the United States which has gone horribly, horribly wrong. And if that's where the slippery slide takes us to, we just don't want to go there. Where you have these committees sitting in boardrooms and very, very powerful lobby groups funded by big business. And that's where party political funding ends up taking this. It's the wrong direction. It must do everything to stop that. I must say as well that I fully support the application that my vote count took, and particularly the emphasis of the judge saying that in order to make an informed decision as a voter, I need to know what funding is. It is my right in terms of making that informed decision. My presentation may come across as being critical of the Western Cape government, but it is not necessarily so. It's just where I live. And if there was any antagonism war against corruption, then and the possibility of corruption. I would say to you, in all these interactions with these NGOs that I'm involved in, there is a serious breakdown between the local communities and government, in particularly on the local level. And it seems to be decisions made at the local government and provincial government level, where we are the closest to seem to be motivated on things that communities don't want. And just to say that the Komiki Ratepayers Association is right now in the High Court fighting the City of Cape Town on a development issue that 80% of the community of Komiki don't agree with. We don't have any funding, and of course the City of Cape Town does, so we've got the odds stacked against us. So what has all this got to do with party political funding? And the crux of what I presented and is in front of you is the enormous gearing that occurs when a local authority is given the right to rezone a property. The lure is too much. The collusion between property developers and local and provincial decision-making bodies in sharing the spoils of a rezoning is just too much. So what you're finding, and the symptoms are all there, is right across the city, on the edges of the city where you can purchase cheap, often rural or agricultural land, and hey presto, if you can get that rezoned, it turns into gold. And then what we're experiencing is that these developments, undesirable in the outlying areas of the city, are being pushed and bulldozed through, and it doesn't seem to us to be reasonable. So the key thing is that the rezoning of a property, it boils down to an administrative process or administrative decision at a local level. And there is a lot of work that goes into it, EIAs and environmental impact assessment and studies, and there's a whole lot that goes into it, but ultimately the rezoning happens within a spatial development framework at a local level. But what happens as soon as a property is rezoned? The property itself can attain enormous up value. And surely this can't become, in my view, inherited by the property, the current property owner. Because as soon as you have such enormous profit that emerges out of a rezoning, the sharing of the spoils is way too easy. And this is really the crux of what I've tried to highlight in my presentation. And is it happening? Of course we don't know, because the parties that may receive the benefits of such gearing up, that information up to now has been shrouded in secrecy, and there's no way we can connect the dots. But the symptoms are all there for us to see. So there's quite a number of, and I'm just talking about the Western Cape, of rezonings that are happening on the edges of the city. Objections from the communities, we have certainly, you know, the current one in the media would be the Philippi Horticultural Area, which is, you know, heritage, it's a farming area, but certainly it looks like they're trying to, whether that's the city or the province or whatever, they're trying to force it through to have that whole area or part of that area developed. We also had the instance where Spelem, which is the spatial planning land use management committee, object or turn down certain applications, and shortly after that the decision of rejecting them is then overturned by the mayoral committee, and then they're therefore approved. And so we're seeing a lot of the symptoms of these type of what we call rezoning, unnecessary and against what the community wants, being pushed through. And just to give you some examples, and the example that the issue that, and I don't even know, there's no ways I can join the dots to say whether there was corruption in such a process. But in Komiki, the area that there was a piece of land about 12 hectares in size, its current value before rezoning may have been generous, 2 or 3 million rand. It's been rezoned and development approval for 103 ERFs. So that'll turn it from 3 million rand to probably estimated 150 million rand. And that is inherited, simply inherited, Father Christmas gift to the owner of the property. Similarly, we've had such developments in Durbanville, currently, as I mentioned, in Philippi. Princess Flay was probably the only one where the people fought it off, and that one was finally rejected. But again, in Stellenbosch, Somerset West, in the Langebaan Lagoon, and Amanus. So, what do you do about this? the key thing I'm trying to put across is that the size, the magnification of the profit that gets endowed onto the existing property owner is way too lucrative and is easy to share. I think in terms of the act, of what we're dealing with here, this proposed act, there's, in a financial sense, there's always the difference between the donor and the donee. And the donor, a donor can donate me something, but the donee has to accept. And in the case of what we're dealing with here, the donee will always be a political party, as it's stated. And there may be instances where the donee, and if we look at section 9.2, what would make an improper donation, there may be instances where the donee is required in terms of its act to return the donation or not accept it. As sort of the, let's call it the possible proceeds of a corrupt process, if you like. But a more sort of outrageous, and this is not really the subject of this committee, but something maybe if there's members of the Finance Committee or the Tax Committee, is to say that the owner of a property that which becomes magically or happily rezoned would have to purchase the upgraded value of the property from the state. That is an interesting idea, in that I own a property with a particular zoning. If the state agrees to rezone it, I don't own that. I would have to purchase it from the state. I own it in its original format. And that would then force a situation where rezonings would happen for the right reasons and not for any nefarious purpose. A slightly softer approach would be, in the same instance, as soon as the property is rezoned, that the current owner would be, they would treat it as a capital gains event, and that person may need to purchase or pay capital gains tax in order to then buy the upgraded valuation. Either of those two may have the approach of taking away the potential for corruption in such a process. So that is my presentation. If there's any questions.
Thank you very much, sir. Maybe I should start. Members can. I think we have been at pains to make clear that what we're busy with is not a money bar. And I'm not sure cleverer people than I am, Mulder and self and others, can assist me. But I get the sense that if we start talking about capital gains tax and that type of thing, it ventures towards a money bill, I would imagine, if that's where we're going to. And then we don't want to go in that direction. But I think, sir, just without saying what you're saying is right or wrong or there's proof or no proof, but I think that the section that you're talking to, political parties may not accept donations that is known to be proceeds of crime or whatever, would address what you're talking about if we adhere to disclosure. Because if I know that a political party is getting money from property developer X, and when we follow the money, property developer X has just been involved in a project where there was rezoning. I'm sure we could connect the dots type of thing. So I almost get a sense that if this bill is put into place and it's adhered to, it would overcome what you're talking about. But that's just my own sense. I don't know what members, if there are any views, but I do think, other than tampering with what we're doing, the fact that we are arguing for disclosure goes a long way in addressing whatever concerns there might be, not just of this example, but any example of income from investment arms, income from tenders, income from that type of stuff. That's just my initial take, but do members have any comments to make, and we'll allow you to comment on the comments or questions if there are any questions. Anybody who has any honorable comment?
In a Thank you very much, Mr. Klein. I just wanted to say that I thank you for the insight that you have given us, particularly around land use profiteering. Thank you very much. Thanks, Representative.
Let's take Self, and then we'll end up with Matthijs.
Thank you very much, Chair. So I understand the argument. You are suggesting that in respect of rezoning applications, there is a inherent risk of corruption. And although you say you can't join the dots and you're hoping this bill will provide the evidence of that, there is, of course, an alternative explanation, particularly on places like the urban edge. I mean, since you happen to talk about Cape Town, I mean, there's a large number, a very large number of people requiring housing in the city of Cape Town. And there's only limited places for residential development. Those tend to be on the edge. And, you know, unless one has evidence of collusion, I think it's, with respect, irresponsible to imply that there's collusion if one has no evidence of it. And, you know, I really do think that if you come to a parliamentary committee and make an assertion of that nature, I think it behoves you to have some more definite proof of that.
Honourable Matej.
Thank you, Chair. I think that your presentation could have been better prepared for another committee and spoke more to what it is. So I was covered by the chairperson pretty much on that. But just on a lighter note, I think the issue with the rezoning and the issue of land that has been sold that should really be belonging to our people should be easily resolved with the nationalization, or rather the expropriation of land without compensation. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
You know, Honourable Matthijs, my ancestors were with me today. Before you arrived, there was a presentation made that if you or your colleague were around, I think it would have meant the bouncers were going to come into this room. So, but I buy your argument. Sir, over to you.
I think in terms of nice to know, it may be post the event, if I'm a forum involved in a particular committee, and we find out 2 or 3 years later, after all it's been approved, that so-and-so property developer also made a contribution to the local political party. It's not good enough to be just nice to know in disclosure. My sense is that Section 9.2 should particularly attempt to make such a, if we were to join the dots, that to be specifically unlawful. I work in the financial industry, services industry, and disclosure of anything suspicious is become a very serious and sort of, you know, highly topical thing. And I would like to see such, if such dots can be joined, that it ultimately the donee, the political party involved, would need to either disclose it or return it. And if not, that would become unlawful. It's not good enough to just know. The size, the magnification of the profit, as I've tried to put across, is just too great, in my view. On the question of the large number of needed houses on the periphery of the city, there are on the periphery a number of developments that have occurred for the low-cost needs, but most of them, with respect, are gated villages of very expensive homes that do not serve the needs of those masses of people who need it. And those are happening in Stellenbosch, Sunset West, Durbanville, Comedy, and all around the peninsula. And whether we've got proof of it or not, the property, I won't disclose the name, but the developer who got away with the development in Yangebaan admitted he made a political party donation. He didn't necessarily join the dots, but the evidence for us is in against and right against all community comment objecting to such developments that the development imperative seems to take precedence. It's very difficult for us to join the dots because of the secrecy, and I would like it honestly that the party would know and they would be obligated to return the funds under the burden of it becoming unlawful. It is the only way to stop it. Okay.
Thank you. So I think you reconfirm the urgency for this piece of legislation, because it says the political party may not accept, and then it goes further and it says it must report. Now even if the party doesn't report, whether it's Party Kumede or Party Mulder, some of us that pick it up will report, as well as all of you. So I think it just emphasizes the urgency of this kind of legislation to overcome that problem. Mr. Ryan, thank you very much for your input, and hoping that the interaction is seen just as that, as interaction, and not necessarily us and them or you and I, but members of our drafting team will take all this into consideration, including the transcripts. But I think it just re-emphasizes the urgency of disclosure, the urgency of parties knowing what's right and wrong, so that there can be consequences. And those consequences can only come through accountability, transparency, and so on. So thank you very much, sir, for your time and for your efforts. We appreciate it. Mr. Murray is around. Yes, Mr. Murray. Again, also in his private capacity. Mr. Murray's presentation is the fifth one in your, or the in-depth presentation is the fifth in your slide, or in your files, honourable members. Mr. Murray also has 10 minutes, and we will also afford 10 minutes for engagement. Mr. Murray, therefore, around about 22, we'll start looking at you, 1:45 at the absolute latest, and thereafter we'll engage, and that will be the last presentation for the day. There isn't any. So we'll have to go to the actual presentation. There's no summary, but over to you, sir. And once again, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for the effort, and thank you for availing yourself today. Having witnessed the proceedings, I'm sure you are prepared for what is about to happen to you. Over to you, sir.
To the chair, thank you for the opportunity to present. I'm going to assume that my submission has been read and wish to expand on the comments I made regarding allowing anonymous donations. I want to stress the differences between secrecy and privacy, that this bill and the committee have the opportunity to remove the secrecy for party funding whilst at the same time preserving and respecting individual privacy. I also want to stress that my comments relating to privacy pertain to private individuals only. I have no feelings about foreign governments and corporates. Professionally, I am a data scientist. I spend my working days analyzing data, and then I spend my private hours worrying about the rise of the machines and protection of individual privacy as technology companies indiscriminately suck up more and more of our private data, turning us, the consumers, into the product. I'm hoping my experience in this regard directly relates to what this bill will hopefully not do. Now, knowing who donated to a political party is not going to be a magical bullet for ending corruption. One can endlessly sketch out scenarios over who pressured who and how a donation led to a contract, and like the examples that were given by the editors forum. But all these scenarios are misleading because they they present as knowing things we will never know. If we allowed full disclosures and a donation was used as a bribe to award a tender, we would know two things. One, that John Doe won a contract, and that two, John Doe made a donation. We can all make claims and guess what happened, but at the end of the day, we must deal with facts. I shouldn't have to remind this committee of this, but correlation doesn't necessarily imply causation. Even if the tender was awarded because of the donation and it went to court, the facts that John Doe won a contract and made a donation in of themselves would be nothing more than circumstantial evidence. Your case would be no stronger than if all you knew was that John Doe won a contract and someone made a donation. Now, I'm not dismissing the examples of saying that tenders for donations never happen. The point I want to make is that simply having a name doesn't help you. The idea that all donations are inherently corrupt, I believe, is misguided. And what the people putting forward these notions actually want is open tenders, not a privacy violation of everybody because of a few corrupt acts. The bill, in whatever form it eventually takes, does not have to last for the next 50 or 10 years. For the moment, I would say allow anonymous donations and simply declare them all. Let the IEC manage it, have it recorded. This would achieve the purpose of the bill as much as it would reveal the names of donors reveals the fact that there was donations without necessarily invading anyone's privacy. As things currently stand, we know nothing. We have no idea how much money flows into the political parties. We have no idea whether donations come from a handful of people or from several thousand people. We cannot legislate in the dark, just as much as we cannot legislate for the naughty kid in the class. And recent events can attest that once private information is out there, it's very difficult to get it back. And there are many examples where knowing names of donors has led to intimidation. I mean, people simply stand for a position and are murdered. What would happen if you now had names attached to money? So there's no hard data that categorically proves that having names next to donations solves our problems. Honourable members, I guarantee you that if there are names attached to donations, the day after the very first published report, a newspaper will have some version of Party X supported by John Doe, or John Doe supports Party X. Sorry, the editors aren't here for that. Even if John Doe's donation made up less than 0.5% of the total, the fact that he donated will be used to discredit either him or the party. Now, there is a difference between secrecy and privacy. I fully encourage and support this committee's work to lift the veil of secrecy on party funding. Knowing how much was given, in what form it took, what the distribution of donors looks like, the key here is the distribution. It's about the number, the pattern, the size, the timing of donations. And this you can know without having names. As I said in my submission, if people donating had anonymizing identifiers, so all you knew was donor 123 and donor 456, say, then you can protect their privacy and raise the secrecy veil. Now an enterprising NGO can make a pointed and narrow PIA request. They can ask the political party, assuming PIA gets amended, who is donor 456, and because we suspect X, Y, and Z, right? It's instead of saying, give us everything, you can narrow down that request. Then, if the donor wishes to come forward, they can. If the party wants to take it to court and say there is nothing untoward, they can. If the NGO is not happy with the response, they can take it to court. With this approach, we don't have to make the tacit assumption that everyone who donates represents a corrupt relationship. Let us allow anonymous donations. Let us open those doors slowly and measured. We have come this far without knowing. One more election cycle with values is not going to harm us. The Republic is going to be around for at least the next 100 years. When we have some information, we can repeat this process. But this time, we will all have a better idea of what we're dealing with. And no one will have to thumbsuck values over minimums or maximums or how many's for disclosure. Those who think that knowing who donated will help fight corruption can then come back and tell us how many cases of corruption they've solved and how easier it would have been if they had names. We must be careful when doing these things while panicking. As Parliament, I want to urge you to play the long game here. There should be no shame in being unsure and testing legislation with baby steps. And then before ending, I just want to make a few side comments. Please don't be fooled when people say best practice. The best there simply means what everyone else is doing, for better or for worse. I have picked on some people, but no one's here, so that's fine. And please do not ban foreign donations. Some submissions said that foreign donations, even for policy development, should be banned. I think that's incredibly isolationist. Just because the idea comes from somewhere else and it's not ours doesn't inherently mean it's bad. And this has been raised many times over the course of today, please don't put the IEC in a position where there's even a remote possibility of it being politicized. It hasn't even begun to touch donations, and we also have examples of political leaders subtly undermining the electoral process, accusing the IEC of fraud. Thank you so much.
And your presentation is very welcome, sir. Sometimes you like to be challenged and bantered, especially this time of the afternoon. But where we come from, you must be prepared to accept what you give. So let me start. You make an astonishing comment by saying that we should allow anonymous donations immediately after an independent court says that, in its view, it's unconstitutional. I'm saying that because you started off by saying that, you know what, guys, you go to any court and you give a name, you don't give anything else, you lose the case. So you rely on the courts to be able to say that, but at the same time you say, whatever the Western Cape High Court said, is throw it out of the window. Maybe you must explain that, because it's just astonishing for me for somebody to say that we must allow anonymous donations. And I speak again under corrections. I am not sure, so you must explain it to me. When you say anonymous, I'm assuming you're saying that if it goes to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, the IEC, at least the IEC must know who's donating. They don't have to make it public. If it goes to Party X, Party X must know who it is. It must not be made public. Because if you're saying that Party X must receive money without even knowing who's giving it, or the Multi-Party Democracy Fund must receive without even knowing who's giving it, then I think you're in the wrong place. I really think you're in the wrong place, because it means that we would allow drug lords and all those people to be able to donate if we don't know the source. And I don't even think the FICA Act allows for acceptance of money without knowing the source. So I'm just putting all these things to you. You'll clarify them to us. FICA makes it an offense to do that. That's the point that I'm making. That's why I'm putting them to you. And then the notion of foreign donations. You know, some of us will die defending the sovereignty of South Africa, because that's how important it is to some of us. Now, when you say to me we should allow foreign donations, and I'm again saying devil's advocate, it is highly possible that some rogue government, some rogue rich individual outside of our borders would donate to Party X with the sole proviso that when we donate to you, you shall do X, Y, and Z in our interest. And today we might be living with angels that will not fall for that, but there's no guarantee that tomorrow we will be living with people that are less than angels and will sell the country down for 30 pieces of silver. So those are the points that I'm putting on your one. And again, I'm not yesing or knowing. I said to you, you were able to give it to us. Let's give it back to you. And answer it. So your foreign donation thing, please explain it to us in light of my fears of selling the country for 30 pieces of silver. Your issue around anonymous donations should be allowed in light of the Western Cape judgment, and what are you saying about our judicial system in this country? And finally, when you say secrecy and privacy, are you implying that the recipients must know and they don't have to make it public, or are you implying that even the recipients don't have to know where the money is coming from? So those are my three points. But if members have anything else to add, to subtract from, please do so. And then we'll allow you, Mr. Murray, to comment. Anybody wants to take a second bite? Honorable Matthijs.
Thank you, Chair. So essentially, you don't really want the dynamics of political party funding changed, because as it stands now, there's no necessary disclosure. You're just saying, okay, political parties must know, and if the IEC was going to be the watchdog, so to speak, if they decide and they want to investigate, that they must ask. Essentially, that is what you're saying. And then you're also saying we have been reactionary to the state of what our country is at the moment, but this bill has been long time in the running, and we've come to this point because the country is in the state, probably because of a lot of decisions or us not amending this bill for such a long time. So we'd also like you to speak to that. And disclosure, people are not obligated to donate. So if you don't want to donate and you don't want your money to, and you don't want your name to be out there, if you feel that passionate about this political party that you so want to donate and so want to support to, why don't you want people to know about it? Because we want voters to know. The whole thing is that our electoral processes must be clear, and we're trying to create an environment in South Africa where we know where our political parties stand, what are they doing, what's influencing them, and money is the key foundation to all that. So speak to that. How are voters going to make informed decisions if we don't know where they're getting their money from?
Anybody else? No?
Nobody else? Okay. Oh, Mr. Gumede?
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Murray. I just wanted to check. If now you make donations that are not identifiable, how do you know where they come from, one source? Because the real problem here is that if the donations are of a low individual magnitude, but collectively and combined they are of a sizable quantity that can influence a party, how do you play with those dynamics? Thank you.
King somewhere here, and maybe Mr. Mulder can help me. Does the Constitution not make reference to transparency and accountability and that thing? If it does, please show me where. Because I'm putting that to you, sir, saying to you, if you can help us in that one. I'm just trying to challenge this young man. He comes and he says there should be no transparency. If the Constitution says there must be transparency, how does he answer
I
that?
Think you can start by looking at provision 1, founding provisions of the state. Founding provisions of the state, section 1, I think.
Okay. Again, like I say, we're not being nasty, but it's the nature of this committee. So we've thrown that to you. You can respond in any way you wish, and in any, you can take anyone first. Again, our scribes are noting it, and also the transcript people. And then we will consider all your responses. But go for it, and if there's going to be a second round, we'll allow them, and you'll have a second bite, but go for the first round. Thank you, sir.
The question, I think, to answer the one about anonymous donations, and I think the Honourable Committee asked something similar to that, is I'm not saying that we don't know, right? I'm not saying that this an amount of money will just arrive in whatever fund and no one will know. what I'm saying is that the public won't know, right? So that's, I think, the difference between privacy and secrecy. The donor is allowed to keep their privacy, right? But the secrecy veil is lifted because that amount will still be reported. So we as the public will know that someone donated this amount. In my original submission, I said with allowing these, giving someone an identification number. So not only would you know that donor 123 donated, you would also be able to track that person's donations over time. Right? So it's not every donation, it's just completely anonymous and it's the Wild West. Right? I hope that answers that question. On foreign donations, I didn't say that we should allow foreign donations and sell our sovereignty. I said it was just foreign donations for policy development. Right? And so if someone who, however we term foreign, says, I want to give you this money to help you develop this policy because we have recently gone through a drought or we expanded our city, come and have a foreign tour, those are the types of things I'm talking about. As for an actual foreign state injecting cash into the political party, I would err on the side of not allowing, but I never touched that in my speech now. It was just policy. I hope that answers that question. I do want to challenge the status quo with regards to current funding, in that what I'm saying is we must disclose, but we must do so opening the doors slowly. And that I know the harm that can come of saying, yes, let's open everything up, when the consequences of that are unknown. And I want to err on the side of caution to say, let's try with anonymous, see what the amounts are, because we don't know, right? And I'm supporting the disclosure. I'm saying, yes, publish the amounts. What I'm not supporting is attaching names to those amounts, because that, I think, is, and I will try my best to interpret things in the Constitution to say that the right to vote has been interpreted to be a right to make an informed vote, right? Whereas the right to privacy is an inherent right. There is no need to read into that. There is no need to expand. It's an explicit right that's given in the Bill of Rights that says every person has the right to privacy. Even the promotion of information, promotion prior, allows you to only violate that right when other rights are being violated. It's not a free-for-all. I hope that answers that question with regards to reactionary. I think making an informed vote is a very slippery slope when we start attaching money to things, because the argument could be made, well, if I'm going to vote for this person or the leader of this party, do I want to know what books they read? Because maybe that informs how they think if we're going to say that money changes their minds. Do I want to know where they hang out on Sunday nights, because maybe they're meeting with other people who have strange views. It's a very slippery slope that you can get stuck on. I can understand why we stick with money, because it's easy to measure, right? You can say you received this much money. You can't say to someone, oh, you read this book, but it only influenced you 20%, right? And so that's my slight interpretation of informed votes.
So earlier this morning, the second or third presenter said that if we go down your route, this bill will be challenged the very next day. And that is on the assumption that the Western Cape decision will be confirmed by the Constitutional Court. Are you suggesting, because the Western Cape's judgment is basically saying disclose, are you suggesting that we somehow hope that somebody challenges that at the Constitutional? Because outside of it being challenged, we've got no other room. So are you suggesting that decision be challenged? That's why I've asked you the question. What are you saying about the Western Cape judgment? Because it's a real question that we have to answer. It's a real question that we have to answer before we take this bill to Parliament. And that's why we asked the question. And that's why I said when you raised it, it was very welcome, because I don't think we should all conform to what the first person says. The question that I'm asking now is, in light of the Western Cape statement, that disclosure is absolutely necessary. I think that's what they said, Janine. If I'm interpreting it correctly, that's what they said. Are you then now saying to us that, well, let's go and challenge it and reverse it, because the court shouldn't have the final say on a matter like this? Is that what you're saying, just in terms of that one? Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a legal expert. I'm going to give my best interpretation of this. I'm sure there are people that know more. My reading would be that the judgment said two things. Firstly, that PIA missed out political parties. Totally accept that. Makes sense. Right? You should be able to request that information using a PIA request. But then there were other aspects of the judgment that concerned how people would actually use those requests. So under the assumption that PIA gets corrected, you would now be saying that because money is part of having an informed vote, every voter would have to submit a PIA request to every party to get that information. And so to ease that administrative burden, it would be easier to just disclose it. Right? I also agree with that. But when it comes to disclosing, what is the difference with disclosing to limit the administrative burden, right? What is the difference between having a political party report its financial statement and it says donor 539 donated this much money, because now the administrative burden on their PIA request is reduced. You now no longer have to ask the political party for everything because you know nothing. You can ask for that one pointed line. And you can say, who is this person that gave you 10 million rand? PIA has been fixed. Party must comply. If the party doesn't, or they suspect something's untoward, you can now adjudicate that, instead of just casting everything out into the open. Because if you had a name there, what are you going to do with that name? You then have to find out who this person is. What do they think? Have they done anything to the party? Do they hold strange views that I disagree with, or views that I do agree with? But if they just hold those views, has the party taken on board those views? Have they incorporated it into the policy statement? But if it's in the policy statement, then I already know about it because it's part of their policy. It becomes a very strange gray area that just assumes that there's some sort of relationship here that may not necessarily be the case. And I don't think, again, I'm not commenting on our judiciary, but I don't think that necessarily warrants a limitation on the rights of privacy. Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you very much. Honourable members, food for thought. We will take it that might be okay to say donor X, Y, and Z donated and not put the name, but these are things that even our legal team must look at in light of the judgments and those type of things. But we welcome all inputs. Those that are listening to us that have a different view tomorrow will probably challenge you tomorrow. And we will put all that in the pot and take it from the honourable members and our colleagues. Thank you very much for assisting us today. Let us again reiterate that we will listen to a similar type of thing tomorrow and the IEC on Friday. And thereafter we will, as a committee, go and panel be the final product that will go to the House by the 30th at the latest, hopefully incorporating all the wisdom that you've shared with us. Thank you very much to our friends in the media. Honourable members, we're back here tomorrow at 9:10, and we will then in the main be dealing with people who have been here before. Today, most of the participants today had not been here previously. But tomorrow, most of the participants tomorrow are people that would be here for the second time. 9:10 in the Old Assembly. Oh, 9 o'clock in the Old Assembly, I beg your pardon. 9:10 we start. 9 o'clock in the Old Assembly, and we'll probably finish pretty much the same time tomorrow. And even those that have participated, you are more than welcome to come in and observe the deliberations tomorrow. It's free for everybody. Thank you very much, honourable members. See each other at 9:10.
at 9 o'clock, I beg your pardon, in the same venue. Mr. Murray, thank you so much, sir, and give your number to Cindy. You and I will have a beer sometime and have a discussion. But thank you very much. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned until tomorrow.